Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 22, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as today we discuss Brexit and secession. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today two experts. We'll hear from opening remarks from each of about 10 to 12 minutes, and then a second, much shorter round of remarks. And then, as always, questions from the audience, so please do be ready with those questions. We welcome today Professor Ilya Soman. He's a professor of law at the George Mason University School of Law, now the Antonin Scalia Law School. He'll be followed in opening remarks by Professor Philip Booth, who's the editorial and program director at the Institute of Economic Affairs and professor of insurance and risk management at Cass Business School. With that, Professor Ilya Soman, welcome. The floor is yours.
I'd like to start by thanking the Federalist Society for organizing this event and all of you for listening, and also Philip Booth for participating all the way from London. Today, I'm going to talk first about general principles about secession. How should we judge secession movements? By what criteria? And then I'll go on at the end to apply some of these ideas to the case of Brexit, since, of course, the Brexit vote is coming up tomorrow. So some people argue that certain groups deserve an intrinsic right of secession regardless of the consequences of what might happen after they secede. Some libertarian theorists, for example, argue that if there is a group living in a territory where you get unanimous consent from the group to set up a new state, then they should be allowed to do that. I actually have some sympathy for this view, but I think in the modern world, it virtually is never the case that we do, in fact, have unanimous consent within a given territory. So for the rest of my remarks, I will presume that what we're talking about are secession movements where there's at least a substantial minority who disagrees with the effort of secession. And the question is, should we allow the secession to occur anyway? Now, in addition to a kind of right of individual autonomy that I just mentioned, there are also many people who believe that secession is intrinsically justified if you have a distinct ethnic or racial or linguistic group of some sort, like the French Canadians in Quebec, for example, the Catalans in Spain and others. And so it is thought that these sorts of distinct ethnic groups have an inherent right to secede, even if other territories don't necessarily do so. I think this view is flawed for a couple of reasons. One is, in the modern world, really even throughout history, we have many thousands of distinct ethnic groups out there in the world, and it is simply impossible for more than a small fraction of them to have any kind of meaningful right to secession or to have any kind of general ability to set up their own state. Second, and perhaps more importantly, I think race and ethnicity are actually morally arbitrary characteristics. They don't say anything about the moral worth of the people involved or about what kinds of rights or freedoms they should have. This is why, at least in the U.S. and also in many other countries, we've put severe limits on the rights or the power of the government to discriminate on the basis of race or ethnicity. And I think it's a bad principle to say that groups defined by race or ethnicity should have special rights that are not given to other kinds of groups. Ultimately, I don't believe there is any inherent right to be ruled by a government composed of people of your own racial or ethnic group. What there is a right to be ruled by a government which is just and respects your individual freedom and hopefully also promotes your happiness and prosperity. So overall, I think when we look at secessions, we should look at them from an instrumental point of view, not are they inherently good or bad, but what the results will be. And a couple of criteria that I think are relevant are, first, whether the secession promotes individual freedom, and then secondly, whether it promotes people's happiness and long-term prosperity. And when we judge secessions, it should be with these instrumental principles in mind. And in particular, one thing we want to look at is what purposes are the would-be secessionists trying to achieve. In some cases, it's pretty clear the secessionists are trying to increase freedom and increase people's happiness and prosperity, and that they're likely to achieve that. For example, when the Baltic states seceded from the Soviet Union in 1991, it was pretty clear that the result would be greater freedom and human happiness. At the other extreme, you have cases where the secessionists are in fact seeking to perpetuate or extend oppression. Obvious example from American history, the secession of the South during the Civil War, where the goal was to preserve the evil institution of slavery. And then obviously there are ambiguous cases in the middle where the purposes of the secessionists may be harder to evaluate. Obviously, it's not enough to just look at what the secessionists are trying to do. You also want to compare their agenda to the existing government. In some cases, it will be clear that what the secessionists are trying to do, although perhaps flawed, is far better than the oppression of the existing state. In other cases, the reverse may be true. And another important general question that might be asked is, should there be a right of secession built into a constitution? As, for example, in the case of Canada, the Canadian Supreme Court has ruled that the province of Quebec has a right to secede. And I think actually there's no general principle that can categorically answer this sort of question across the board. I think it will usually depend on the particular history of the nation in question. For example, it may depend on how powerful the central government is. The more powerful it is, the more territories come within it, the more it may be valuable to have a right of secession to check potential abuses. Also, it's important to ask whether there's a history of oppression within that government, and in particular, whether there are particular regions which historically have been oppressed. To the extent that's true, you may want to give those regions a right of secession so as to curb that sort of oppression and misbehavior, and in the extreme case, allow them to leave so as to end the oppression permanently. So with these principles in mind, let's think about the case of Brexit. I think one thing that I think most of us can probably agree on is that in the case of Brexit and the European Union generally, it is desirable that individual nations have a right to secede, given the enormous potential power of the European Union, and given that it takes in an incredibly diverse range of nations and cultures and groups where there is a real potential for oppression if you just have a central government where there's no exit right whatsoever. Now, having said that, the fact that the right should exist, there's a more difficult question about whether it's a good idea for Britain to exercise it at this particular point in time. And I think there's both downsides and upsides to the potential for Brexit. On the downside, I think whatever might be said of the European Union generally, and it certainly has flaws, it has had three enormous achievements. Specifically, it has enabled free trade, free migration, and largely free flow of investment over this vast territory. And in particular, when it comes to trade and migration, that has both increased individual freedom greatly, both for the British and for the other peoples of Europe, and it has greatly increased people's happiness and economic well-being. In particular, in the case of Britain, the fact that there are now hundreds of thousands of Frenchmen, Poles, and other people from other parts of the European Union living there, that has enormously transformed the lives of those migrants, and it has also given a boost to the British economy, which benefits greatly from their presence. If Britain leaves the EU and free trade and free migration are cut off or significantly diminished, that will both greatly diminish freedom and also cause considerable economic harm. Now, it is possible that after a Brexit, Britain will negotiate some sort of deal with the European Union to restore free trade and free migration, or at least some degree of it, but it's by no means certain that this will occur, and particularly in the case of migration, it may well not occur, because for many of the supporters of Brexit, one of the principal goals of leaving the European Union in the first place is in fact to end free migration. So I think there's at least a high likelihood that there will be substantial damage in these areas if Britain leaves the European Union. Although there are, I think, these significant downsides to Brexit, there are some upsides as well. One is that Britain would be free of all or most of the European Union's many petty regulations of various kinds, which collectively do impose significant economic costs on Britain. Another is that the British would be free of the EU system of transfers and taxation, on which Britain is currently a net loser. The EU has chosen to subsidize in various ways some of Europe's more dysfunctional economies, and Britain tends to lose out on that, and so that could potentially end. I think these are real upsides to Brexit, but in my judgment, they don't outweigh the downsides, in part because the benefits of free trade and free migration are so enormous that it just takes a great deal on the other side to outweigh them, and I don't think there is actually quite enough there. It is also not entirely certain that an independent Britain really would regulate less than it currently does under the European Union. And if an independent Britain tried to restore free trade with the EU, it's possible that the EU would insist that Britain must obey various EU regulations anyway. Finally, if Britain does stay within the European Union, there's a decent chance that Britain could cooperate with other nations skeptical of centralization to limit the European Union's power in various ways. So on balance, I think there are strong arguments on both sides. I would say that I'm moderately opposed to Brexit, but I would also caution that whether Britain stays in the European Union or whether it leaves, there's a lot of uncertainty about what would happen. So I would be lying to you if I said I could make anything like definitive predictions about what will happen. I think on balance, Brexit is probably a bad idea, but I don't blame people who think otherwise. And on that note of not entirely complete confidence, I will turn things over to Philip Booth. Thank you.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the opportunity to take part in this teleforum. You may hear a little bit of background noise from behind me because I have a window open because this being England, we don't have air conditioning here. So I want to really start where Ilya left off, and I actually want to start talking about the issue of centralization within the UK state, within the European Union, and then move on to the issue of secession. Now, and in particular, I want to talk about federalism in the UK context. Federalism has a very bad reputation in the UK. It's most frequently associated with centralization and the creation of a European superstate and thereby the end of British sovereignty in an EU context. And as such, it's virtually impossible to get any traction proposing a federal model for the United Kingdom unless we use a different word altogether. So perhaps we can adopt the concept but not use the word federalism. And the idea that the degree of centralization and the degree to which a country is federal are really part of the same metric is just false. The degree of centralization and the degree to which a country is federal are two entirely separate axes, and that is simply not generally understood in Britain. And as it happens, indeed, the British state is highly centralized, probably the most highly centralized state in the world, and yet it is not federal. Yet in Britain, we fear federalism in the EU because we believe it will create a centralized superstate. So there's something of a paradox there, if not a contradiction. The various forms of devolution that are taking place in the UK to Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and to some extent within England, are reversing the tendency to centralization in Britain a little bit, but not a lot. So my view is that the UK should, in fact, adopt some form of formal federal government, that the central federal government should be in charge of defence, foreign policy, border control, management of the inherited national debt, and if we keep central banks, monetary policy and banking regulation, but absolutely nothing else. All other policy matters should be left to the home nations, Scotland, Wales, England, and Northern Ireland, which would then raise all their own taxes to finance their own spending. And crucially, I think any transfer of powers upwards to the federal level after the original settlement came into force should require unanimous agreement of the home nations and the federal parliament. And I think this is really important to stop the drift towards centralization. The US and the European Union in particular have developed systems which have led to centralization because so many countries have come into the EU, so that the use of unanimity in order to pass more and more regulation at the central level has not been possible. Now, when it comes to the European Union, there is no doubt that it has a problem in relation to the centralization of government. And I think, in fact, the starting point for this, the origin of centralization within the EU, is really similar to the starting point for centralization within the United States. We have the Single European Act, which really gives authority to the European Union to regulate any business activity which has anything to do with trade. So it can regulate product standards, regulations for banking and financial services and so on, where it believes that this has a material impact on trade. And this is somewhat, I understand, like the Interstate Commerce Clause within the US Constitution. And once you give responsibility to the center to regulate a business whenever it has anything to do with trade, you get this natural drift towards centralization. So as soon as you give the central authority the power to regulate business in the name of removing barriers to trade, you get an unstoppable drift towards centralization, which I think it's very difficult to reverse. Now, the EU does formally have a supposed check on centralization, which is the principle of subsidiarity, which is written into the EU Constitution. However, the principle, as it's written in the treaties, the European treaties, is not properly defined. The way the principle is described in the EU treaties actually inverts the original meaning of the term subsidiarity. So according to the EU, the principle of subsidiarity means that the European Union is obliged to act where the EU believes that action would be more effective at the center than if action is left to the individual nation states. And one of the EU documents has suggested that action should only be taken, regulation should only be done at the local level where it is absolutely necessary. Now, this is not what subsidiarity should be about. The idea of subsidiarity is that the higher level of government should only intervene if the lower level is not capable of acting. And furthermore, the higher level should only intervene in such a way that it aids the lower level of government and doesn't dictate to it. So if the function can be carried out by civil society or other organizations, the government shouldn't get involved at all. If the function can be carried out at the nation state level, the European Union shouldn't get involved, and so on. And this is actually a concept from Catholic social teaching, which I happen to think is rather crucial in ensuring that government is kept in its proper place. And it was known that it was understood that the EU was taking a concept from Catholic social teaching. The problem was that when it wrote it into its treaties, it wrote it in a way which encouraged rather than discouraged centralization. So this leads to the question of how do we stop centralization at the EU level? We have our equivalent of the Interstate Commerce Clause. We have we have no effective means of ensuring that the subsidiarity principle is effective. Really, all that is left is secession. So the first question is, should secession be allowed? And in my view, without doubt, the answer to that is yes. If people can choose their government so that the government is beholden to the people, within limits, they must be able to choose to exit a particular constitutional arrangement. And that should include nation states being able to exit the European Union. There must be limits, of course, as to how that right of secession can be exercised, and those limits are somewhat prudential, and Ilya talked about how you can think about how to set those limits. Can a household or a village declare independence? Obviously no. Can a sovereign government leave an international arrangement such as the European Union? Well, in my view, obviously it ought to be able to. How do you judge situations in between? It then becomes a bit more difficult. So the final question I've been asked to talk about is whether this right to secession should be institutionalized. And this might be an odd question to an American with a written constitution. And I think the answer to that is relatively straightforward. If the entity, for example, the European Union or Australia or the United States, has a written constitution, then there should be formal rules which allow a state to exit, as indeed there are in the European Union. If you have a written constitution about how a state should be governed, you should have an aspect of that written constitution should deal with how states should be able to leave. In other words, if we have rules by which the club operates, we should have rules by which the club can be exited. If we don't, where we don't have a written constitution, and of course we don't in the United Kingdom, then I'm not sure that you do need formal rules in relation to secession. And I think that the situation in the UK, where there have been secession referenda in both Scotland and Northern Ireland, illustrates that point. Nobody doubts that the UK Parliament would not have recognised the results of those referenda. So this brings me to the final practical question of what would happen if the UK left the EU. Well, the referendum which we'll have tomorrow is not binding on the government. And MPs who do not believe that we should leave the European Union are going to be in a very difficult position if the voters vote to leave. Are they going to vote against their consciences and with the result of the referendum? Or are they going to vote with their consciences and therefore Parliament may defy the referendum? But let's assume that Britain votes to leave and Parliament votes to leave. We then have 2 years to negotiate a new position with the European Union before we formally exit. That might involve us as being members of the European Economic Area, which is a kind of European Union light, or at the other extreme, making no agreement with the EU or anybody else whatsoever and just trading under WTO rules. But what perhaps is most interesting is the link between the European Union result and Scottish independence. Scotland is staunchly pro-European Union. And if the UK votes to leave the EU, it might well trigger another referendum for Scottish independence. And Scotland, as an independent state, if it's the independent camp win that referendum, would then be able to apply for membership of the European Union. But any one single member of the European Union could veto Scotland joining. So that creates a potential degree of huge uncertainty for the United Kingdom going forward, and in particular for Scotland. Untying countries is complex, but I think it's possible and it can be done. And in particular, untying the 40-year-old union between Britain and the European Union might lead to a desire to untie the 300-year-old union between Scotland and the rest of the UK, and then may well have a knock-on effect in the rest of the EU as well. So I think if Britain votes to exit, the potential secession permutations are never-ending.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I want to give each of you a chance to sort of revisit your remarks and maybe respond to what our other speaker has said. With that, Professor Soman, you want to take a couple minutes?
Thank you, Sadat. Those were really excellent remarks by Philip. I do have a couple of thoughts about them and possibly some questions for Philip that he may choose to address if he wishes. First, I think there's a little bit of a conflation in Philip's remarks between the idea of a formal mechanism for secession and the idea of one that's written into the Constitution. I certainly agree with Philip that there isn't always a need for a secession procedure to be written into the Constitution, but even if it's not written into a Constitution, if it exists at all, it would be desirable to have some sort of formalization so that people know in advance how you would go about seceding, what the consequences might be, and so forth. I think that's desirable whether it's in a written constitution or not, or at least it's desirable in any situation where it's desirable to permit secession at all. Second, I thought it was interesting what Philip said regarding the issue of that the final decision may actually rest with Parliament rather than with the voters. My understanding, and Phil, I'm sure, will correct me if I'm wrong, is that in Parliament, there is not a majority in favor of Brexit, in that the Conservative Party is internally divided on Brexit. They're the majority party, whereas most, though not all, of the Labour Party and the Scottish National Party are opponents of Brexit. So it's possible that if the British people vote for Brexit, the popular majority will be in a different place than the majority of Parliament. And that may create an interesting dilemma if Parliament, in fact, chooses to go its own way and to not follow the results of the referendum. And I wonder if Philip thinks that might actually happen. Finally, I would be interested to know whether Philip, on balance, believes that it would be a good idea for Britain to vote for Brexit. Obviously, as he's mentioned, there is this drift towards centralization in the European Union, which is worrisome, but there are also very substantial benefits of the European Union, in particular free trade, migration, and investment, and it's by no means certain that if Britain leaves the European Union that those benefits will be preserved. It's possible that a very large portion of them, or even all perhaps, will be lost. So on that note, I conclude, but I very much look forward to Philip's comments and to the questions.
Okay, shall I respond to those questions? And I have one for Ilya as well.
Yes, please go right ahead, okay. Professor Booth.
Okay. Well, first of all, in relation to whether or not there should be a written procedure for secession, of course, in the UK, we are used very much to what you might call the make it up as you go along constitution, and we've never had written procedures for these types of things, and I'm somewhat Burkean and Hayekian in these matters, and I'm not that keen on having written procedures unless you do have a written constitution. If you have a written constitution, it seems to me simply logical that you have a way which is determined in advance by which it can be determined whether or not an entity within the federation can secede. But we'll have to agree to disagree on that one. I think that this issue of the parliamentary majority being against Brexit is a very interesting one, and not a single member of parliament I'm aware of has actually addressed the issue. So Ilya is absolutely correct. Between 70 and 80% of MPs are in favour of remaining in the European Union, by most estimates. So if there is a vote to leave, then the government has already said it will use executive power to decide whether begin the Brexit procedure. I assume that what will then happen is that the government will be called to account in the House of Commons, and that there will then be a vote in relation to the government's action. My own view is that members of Parliament should follow their own conscience. I think members of Parliament are representatives and not delegates, and if they did follow their own conscience, the government would essentially get voted down, and that creates an extremely difficult constitutional position, especially as David Cameron rather foolishly in the 2010-2015 Parliament put in a provision which made it much more difficult for the Prime Minister to call a general election. So I have absolutely no idea what will happen if the British people vote for Brexit and then Parliament votes against it. And my view is that a member of Parliament who doesn't believe in Brexit should vote with his conscience and not vote with the referendum. That's just how I believe parliamentarians should operate. Would I vote for Brexit myself? Well, I'll be voting tomorrow, or at least my wife will vote for me by proxy, and I shall be voting for Remain. The reason I'll be voting for Remain is because I think that if we left, there is some chance that we'll get some small liberalisation, some small deregulation of the UK economy arising from the fact that we'll be repatriating some powers and we'll be able to take different decisions from those that are taken within the European Union. But I think there's a material risk of, particularly on the migration issue, that Brexit would take us to a much more illiberal position, and that's why I'm voting Remain. So my question really for Ilya, who is much more steeped in the theory of this than I am, is how do you define the geographical area for allowing secession? Perhaps that's easier in a federal state than in a state such as the United Kingdom. So let me use the UK example. So it's generally accepted that Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland could secede from the United Kingdom. There's not much discussion about whether or not England could secede from the United Kingdom and leave the rest behind, which some people would like to see happen. But what about Yorkshire or Cornwall, which not only don't have the status of nations with some aspects of their own legal system, that they don't even have themselves local governments, but they do have very, very strong regional identities. No, so how do you determine at what geographical level secession can take place?
Should I answer?
Yes, please go right ahead, Ilya Soman.
So this is a big and important question. To fully address would require much more time than we actually have, but let me give a few brief thoughts. One is, I think most people would agree that an entity that has a right to secede should be large enough to create a viable nation. But I think history suggests that, in fact, the minimal scale for viability is much smaller than many people think. For example, the city-state of Singapore has been very successful. Also, the even smaller and much smaller city-state of Luxembourg. Even Liechtenstein has been a pretty successful nation. So I think it turns out that at least potentially, even fairly small cities and regions can be viable nations if they're reasonably well-run, as Luxembourg and Singapore and so forth are. So that constraint, while real, may not constrain nearly as much as many people think. Beyond that, as I suggested in my original remarks, I don't think there's a single general principle that can guide us, because it's going to depend greatly on the history of the particular nation and region, on what the pre-existing political boundaries are, on the potential for oppression by the central government of that region, and also, I think, on the potential for oppression if that region secedes, and if it does so for the purpose of perhaps oppressing its own internal minorities. So I think I don't want to seem like I'm somehow evading the question, but I think it's a mistake to believe that there's a single universalizable theory which says this kind of region should be allowed to secede and this kind should not. It really depends, I think, on the particular history and structure of the areas in question, and also of the likely effects of permitting the secession. So I think what makes sense for the UK perhaps may not make sense for some other nations, and similarly, I think what makes sense for the US perhaps may not make sense for other countries as well. So I'm somewhat skeptical about highly general theories about what kinds of regions should be allowed to secede and what kinds should not. I think it's going to depend on particular historical circumstances.
All right, let's open the floor to questions from our audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call now.
Good morning. This is Eileen O'Connor. Thank you so much for this very informative presentation. I have a couple of observations and maybe a compound question that might not be quite within what you're prepared to talk about today, but I read an article this morning saying that Americans should understand Britain's interest in exiting the European Union because Americans chafe against regulations by out-of-touch bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., and similarly, Britain's chafe against regulations imposed by out-of-touch regulators in Brussels. I read another article that shed new light on it, and it talked about the immigration from the Eastern European countries into the UK, lured perhaps by the generous benefits that the government pays to immigrants. And I wondered, so here's the compound question, what is the voting eligibility on the Brexit issue? And two, do you think that the immigration from the Eastern European states, whose people, as I understand it, have not really assimilated into UK culture and still retain ties to their home country, and they would prefer not to have the UK pull out of the EU and therefore sever their ties to their home country. Whoever would feel that.
Do you want me to field it as quite?
Yeah, whoever like to go first, Professor Booth, go right ahead.
Okay, the voting eligibility in the referendum is all British, Irish, and Commonwealth citizens, plus some Britons who have lived abroad in some circumstances. So that's relatively clear. I'm pro-immigration, so perhaps I'm biased, but I would dispute the idea that that the immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe are either lured by benefits or that they haven't integrated into society. I mean, that they tend to work in service industries and have therefore very, very good sort of human contact, if you like, through their day-to-day jobs. And they are, to not put too fine a point in it, I happen to be a Catholic, reviving many Christian churches in the UK which would otherwise decline. And they are, in most parts of the country, I wouldn't necessarily say all parts of the country, I think they are very well integrated. In the north of England, I think they are reviving cities which would otherwise be declining as well in terms of their population. So I don't see a big problem in relation to integration of EU immigrants at all, but there is without question some hostility towards them. On the issue of benefits, we could resolve that problem ourselves, and I think we've decided not to resolve it in order to make it an EU issue, thereby sort of trying to give David Cameron a bargaining chip, if you like, in negotiations. But we could decide not to pay benefits to Central and Eastern European migrants, who, by the way, are net taxpayers and not net recipients of benefits. They have very high employment rates, simply by having a contributory benefit system whereby they had to work for 2 or 3 years or whatever it might be before receiving benefits and applying that to the rest of the population, something which I think would be very popular. I agree with the point about out-of-touch regulators. I think the question in my mind is whether if we left the European Union, we'd actually end up with much less regulation. The British government is also very effective in wrapping businesses, and particularly the financial sector, up in red tape, just as the EU government is.
Thank you very much for that. There's one point that I don't think is quite answered, and that is, are the recent immigrants eligible to vote? You said citizens are eligible to vote. They become citizens?
No, they're not. It's British, Irish, and Commonwealth citizens who live in the UK. So the recent immigrants would not be, as far as I'm aware. I might be wrong, but I think I'm on safe ground there.
Thanks very much.
I'd like to just add one point to Philip's excellent discussion of the immigration question, which is that when we think about issues of immigration, both with respect to Britain and respect to the United States and other countries, I think it's a mistake to discuss it the way that it's often discussed, which is totally without reference to the potential well-being and freedom of the immigrants themselves, and just in reference, is these people's migration benefiting the natives already there or not? I think we should consider effects on natives, absolutely, but we should consider the freedom and well-being of the immigrants themselves also, and in many cases, the effects on that are simply enormous. When an Eastern European comes to Britain, they're able to increase their income and that of their families several fold. It has a tremendous impact. It takes them from being, by Western standards, extremely poor to doing much better than that. And also, it's not just an economic opportunity. Often, it's an expansion of freedom and well-being in many different ways. Now, I'm not saying that always categorically outweighs all effects on natives, although I'm in general in favor of close to open borders migration. I do recognize that if there's a truly catastrophic negative effect, then maybe migration restrictions would be justified. in those situations. But I think in considering whether they're justified and how to deal with the situation, we do want to consider the rights and interests of the potential migrants as well. We can't simply look at it as natives alone, because when you force people to stay out of a country, you are imposing very severe coercion on them, and you're restricting the freedom of both the migrants and also those natives who want to interact with them, hire them, and so forth. And in many cases, even if there are negative effects, one can deal with them in ways short of keeping out the migrants entirely. For example, as Philip has mentioned, if you think that they're consuming too much in a way of public benefits, you can reduce the benefits that they're eligible for, or alternatively, you could increase the taxes that they pay if you wanted to. Both of those are more humane and just and also more economically efficient alternatives to simply keeping the people out entirely.
Thank you.
Our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick commercial announcement while we wait to see if somebody rings in here. The Supreme Court has recently, on Monday, they announced that tomorrow is a decision day for the Supreme Court for the remaining cases. We don't know which opinions will come out tomorrow, but I'm guessing some of them will be notable enough for us to schedule a teleform conference call tomorrow. So please do monitor your emails and check the website for updates to our teleform schedule. Let me ask what might become a compound question. Professor Booth, you mentioned that members of Parliament ought to sort of vote their conscience. Would you be consistent in that? That is, if a member, if the members or the majority of the members were for leave or exit, but the plebiscite was remain, should the members still vote their conscience in that circumstance?
Well, as a practical matter, there will be nothing on which to vote. There's only something on which to vote if the referendum is for leave, because then the government enacts the legislation which is necessary to start the leave process. So that's the case as a practical matter. If somebody brought a motion before Parliament which offered members of Parliament a chance to vote on leaving without a referendum, and I was in favour of leaving and I was a member of Parliament, yes, I would vote in favour of leaving, even if the British people, even if opinion polls suggested that the British people didn't support leaving, because I, in the UK, and I think this is the right thing, it's Parliament rather than referenda that are sovereign. I realise that people have different opinions about that, and in Switzerland there is more direct democracy, and there are people who admire that type of system. But I believe in representative government rather than government by referenda.
Right.
Can I comment on this very briefly?
Please go ahead, Professor Soman.
I think this issue of the potential chaos and uncertainty that will happen in the event of a Brexit vote reinforces my position and my little disagreement with Philip about whether there should be formal procedures for secession that are well understood in advance. I don't think they necessarily have to be written in a constitution or elsewhere, but I think it is desirable if people have an agreed upon sense of how secession works and what the procedures are, because if they don't, and it seems like maybe in this case they don't, you can potentially get very serious problems with uncertainty where it's not clear what Parliament can and will do, and it's not clear what would happen if Parliament refused to pass the government's legislation trying to facilitate Brexit and so forth. And I think other things equal, that kind of uncertainty is something that most nations, I think, would want to avoid.
Oh, no, just to be clear, I think the procedures are very, very clear indeed. It's just a question of how they will be operated. So if there is a Brexit referendum, the government will take an action. The government can then be called to account for that in Parliament, and Parliament can vote either one way or the other. And it's Parliament that is sovereign. And if Parliament decides to vote to affirm the referendum, everything just carries on as normal. If Parliament decides to vote not to affirm the referendum, Parliament has that absolute sovereign right. But then, of course, we just don't, it's not that we don't know what happens constitutionally, we just don't know what the public reaction to that would be if Parliament decided to effectively ignore the result of the referendum, having called one. So constitutionally, the position is clear.
That's a good clarification. Thank you.
Okay.
We do have time for other questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We don't have a question pending. Let me ask again another question. Just from the fallout from this, you've both mentioned and focused a little bit on the regulatory state that is the EU. If Great Britain has gone through this process and decides to remain, is the EU government consequently emboldened in its regulatory tendencies, or it's hard to imagine they might feel chastised by the risk of an exit? Professor Booth?
It's difficult to know, and I'm very worried that the Conservative government doesn't really have a plan B. In other words, it doesn't have a plan to go into what is pretty much an intellectual vacuum in the European Union. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of problems with it in the EU. And I think if the UK Conservative government went in with a clear plan that was also practical to decentralize the European Union, make some institutional reforms and so on, it might actually get more support than it expects. But I just don't really expect the Conservative government to do that. The EU institutions might be emboldened, but this is really the first, certainly the first major secession referendum. And I it's going to be close. And I think that it's possible that in other countries, there having been a referendum that turned out to be close, it may then embolden referendum movements, secession movements in other countries, France, Finland, possibly Holland even, which ought to keep the European Union on its toes. But my concern actually is that it might then force the European Union to do the wrong type of things, because most of these referendum or secession movements actually want to do things like restrict migration rather than reduce regulation, and that might be the direction in which the European Union, in reacting to the a narrow British result which then emboldens secession movements across the European Union, that might be the direction in which it goes.
Professor Soman, anything on this point?
I think it's a very important and also a very difficult question, because one of the difficult things to predict is sort of, A, will the EU be chastened either by a Brexit vote that's successful or one that only is narrowly defeated? And if it is chastened, what sort of lessons will it learn? It could learn the lesson that Philip and I hope it might learn, that they shouldn't be as centralized and shouldn't regulate as much, but it could also learn negative lessons, like they should restrict migration more, or perhaps that they should pay more subsidies to those nations that might otherwise want to secede to give them an incentive to stay in. And also, I think if Brexit is defeated, then there is a question of what strategy should Britain and other nations that are skeptical of centralization pursue within the European Union. Because I think, at least as an outsider, I think there is a potential for them to impose tighter constraints on the EU, maybe even try to roll back some of the powers it currently has. But it's a question of political strategy of how you pursue that. And unfortunately, the situation in recent years in Eastern Europe has in some ways gotten worse from that perspective, in that for quite some time, many of the Eastern European countries pursued a relatively free market agenda and were interested in controlling economic centralization. Over the last couple of years, countries like Poland and Hungary have seen right-wing nationalist governments come to power that are also very statist. And while in some ways they want to limit the powers of the EU, they have less interest in limiting EU economic regulation and more interest in getting the EU to allow them to do illiberal things like censoring their political opponents and things of this sort. So I think both whether Britain stays in or whether Britain stays out or gets out, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen with the European Union, how particular nations and movements will react. I think it's going to be a very interesting time in European history, but also in some ways a dangerous time.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, now's the time to ask it. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a final question then. Hopefully easy to answer, but I'm not sure. Professor Booth, how soon will we know the results, the outcome?
I think it's about 4 or 5 o'clock UK time on Friday morning.
Okay. Very good. We don't have a final question, or we've had our final question perhaps. We've got a few minutes left, so let me revert to each of you and see if you have a final thought or you want to wrap up. We'll go in the order we began. Professor Soman, a final thought?
I think the Brexit issue and the issue of secession more generally is a big issue in the modern world that we're increasingly confronting both in Europe and to some extent elsewhere. I think on the one hand, secession can in some ways help promote liberal principles by constraining over-centralization, by giving people more autonomy, but it can also be dangerous in some ways, as Philip has mentioned, some people who want to leave the EU or some secessionists from individual nation states, what they want to do is actually rule in highly illiberal nationalistic ways, which is also potentially dangerous. So it's uncharacteristic for me, but I have sort of a moderate ambivalent position on secession, even though I'm not moderate about most other things. I think secession can be very good and useful in some instances, but it could also potentially be very dangerous. Lastly, on the question of Brexit, although for reasons I mentioned before, I am generally, I think, in favor of Remain rather than in favor of Leave. I do think it's an extremely difficult issue overall. I think there are serious arguments on both sides of this, and therefore I do not begrudge people who have thought carefully about this and who have come to the conclusion that often the principles that they and I might share, the same principles might be better advanced by Britain voting to leave. I will say lastly that whether Britain votes to stay or whether Britain votes to leave, the U.S. should do what it can to maintain a close relationship with Britain and also to maintain free trade and as much free migration as possible. Although, like President Obama, I favor Remain, I think it was ill-advised for the president to say what he did a few weeks ago, that the U.S. would downgrade its relationship with Britain if Britain voted to leave the European Union. I don't think that sort of statement was either in the American interest or in the British interest either.
Professor Booth, a final thought.
Yes, just taking the discussion from there, it would be wonderful whether Britain stays in the European Union or not if we were to develop better means of promoting free trade, but also particularly free migration and indeed just visiting each other's countries. I think we find each other's procedures in relation to migration and visits extremely exasperating, which between two countries such as the UK and the US, which have so much in common, is really quite inappropriate and something which should be addressed. Finally, if Britain does vote to leave, I think it really is just worth watching what the knock-on effects will be. Will Scotland vote to leave the United Kingdom? If it does, will the European Union be willing to take in Scotland? Germany might oppose it because it doesn't want to be subsidising Scotland in the same way that England is currently subsidising Scotland, it's argued. And there will be other countries, most notably Spain, which would not want to take in Scotland because it doesn't want to encourage its own secession movements. And if Britain votes for Brexit, the knock-on effects in terms of future referendum within the European Union and potentially the whole breakup of the EU project could lead, I think, to some pretty dangerous consequences and illiberal rather than liberal, and I mean that in the UK classical sense of the word rather than the US sense of the word, some rather illiberal outcomes down the line.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating discussion, and we'll watch for results here in the United States. Thank you to Professor Philip Booth for joining us from
thank
London.
You.
Professor Soman, thank you as well. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience to check your emails and monitor the Federal Society's website for our next scheduled telephone conference call, likely tomorrow on a breaking Supreme Court opinion. But until that next call, We are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.